This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
If you have a place that's been governed by just keeping a lid on the tensions and pressures for a very long time, if you have a place where there's a decision to allow for more political space and freedom, it's going to be messy.
That's Michelle Gavin, the Senior Fellow for African Studies at the Council of Foreign Relations, on the recent regional coup attempt in Ethiopia. Details coming up also. Security is tight in Mauritania and internet access has been cut off for a second day in the aftermath of the coup-prone country's presidential election. And the Zimbabwean government has effectively terminated the multi-currency regime, which has been in operation since 2009. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. As we have been reporting, dozens of people have died last Saturday in fighting when a former Amara region security chief attacked the regional governor in Ethiopia. Reuters news agency reports that the regional government spokesman says a rogue militia led by General Asamoah Osige tried to seize control of the media, security forces, and the government. There still is considerable confusion about the events and motives surrounding the attacks Saturday. Five senior officials died in the attacks, including Ethiopia's Army Chief of Staff and the regional president. Those events have stoked concerns over the pace of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's reforms and prompted questions about whether more force will be necessary to quell other regional insurrections. To answer these questions, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Michelle Gavin, the Senior Fellow for African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. A large part of the challenge for Abiy, Gavin says, is the country's history of ethnic division and conflict.
This question of what does Ethiopia's vision of ethnic federalism really mean now? What it used to mean, there were a set of rules on paper, but the EPRDF governed in a pretty authoritarian manner. And the fact is that Tigrayans within the EPRDF were clearly the dominant group. Now it's a new day, and I think that sense of things are up for grabs is leading to some of this churn, which we see reflected in the massive displacement, the communal violence over the last year. I think all of that factors into these very dramatic events of the last few days.
Do you think that there's a general problem with this kind of, shall we call it, insurrection or coup attempts, or is it mostly limited to that state?
I don't think it's just limited to Amhara. This has always been a very challenging question for Ethiopia. It affects access to land, it affects political rights, and you have coming up elections which should require a census. And when you're in a situation in which the division of rights and authorities and powers among different groups is up for grabs, counting exercise is a very sensitive one. So everything's kind of coming to a head. But I also want to be clear that I think this is, to some degree, unavoidable. If you have a place that's been governed by just keeping a lid on the tensions and pressures for a very long time, if you have a place where there's a decision to allow for more political space and freedom, it's going to be messy.
This leads naturally to the question of the prime minister. I mean, he's been very open and quite conciliatory in his approach and his ethos, but there are people who think that maybe he's got a little too far in that direction and needs to be hard in order for his reforms to be adequately realized.
I think that's exactly right. It's this question of balance. There's a tension between we're turning a new page, we have a new governing philosophy and model, and needing to provide everyday security that every Ethiopian is going to depend on to move their country forward. It will be instructive to see how government deals with the aftermath of this episode.
I know you're not a fortune teller, but I'm going to ask you, do you think that he's likely to take a tougher line going forward, at least in the short to middle term?
I think that's unavoidable. You can't have justice without order, right? And things are getting so disordered as to be fundamentally problematic. But I am not convinced that he's going to back off on some of these reforms that do threaten some vested interests, in some cases, in that same security apparatus. So it'll be a matter of very shrewd judgment about who's in place where, trying to empower those who are with the program and move along people who are working to drag the country back.
Michelle Gavin is the former U.S. ambassador to Botswana and currently the senior fellow for African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Security is tight in Mauritania, and internet access has been cut off for a second day in the aftermath of the coup-prone country's presidential election. The government reported it arrested more than 100 foreigners, blaming opposition parties for contacts with outside forces seeking to destabilize the country through protests. Troops were seen near the presidential palace and constitutional council. Mohamed Ould Ghazouni, the hand-picked candidate of the retiring president, won 52% of the vote, according to the official count. The three opposition candidates were trailing far behind, with the best showing only 19%. But the majority result allowed Ghazouni to avoid a runoff election that might have been much closer. The third-place finisher said he has filed an appeal of the results late Tuesday. A fair share of Zimbabwe's problems have been attributed to corruption, much of it linked to politics. In an interesting twist, the ruling ZANU-PF party's youth wing has taken a bold stand against the endemic issue. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has the details.
Louis Matutu is the deputy secretary for ZANU-PF Youth League. Monday, he named and shamed some of the allegedly corrupt individuals within or affiliated to their party. He said the goal is to make corruption a risky and non-profitable venture. The list includes diamonds, pharmaceuticals, bread and basic commodities, as well as long-serving ZANU-PF bigwigs. Matutu vowed to expose others. The approach of naming alleged culprits without supporting evidence is not new in Zimbabwe. In March 2018, President Emmerson Mnangagwa released a long list of individuals and companies who he claimed were externalizing scarce foreign currency. Over a year later, no arrests or convictions have been made. So it's unclear what Matutu's action may achieve. He says this is the beginning of the ZANU-PF youth fight against corruption.
Development of Zimbabwe will be stunned if young people as ourselves, particularly leaders, we fail to root out corruption. A wind of change is blowing under the leadership of President Edi Mnangagwa.
Yes.
And it is in this interest that all well-meaning Zimbabweans must join us in this fight, a fearless fight that we must fight together for the good of our nation.
Critics don't know what to make of this expose. Political analyst Rashid Mukundu calls it the struggle for the post-coup spoils within ZANU-PF and factional struggles over access to resources. In a normal society, corruption is not fought through a smear campaign, but through investigations by well-resourced anti-corruption units and police. Munyara Zidodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament and political developments. He says naming alleged corrupt individuals is a smokescreen.
The timing is rather dubious, to say the least. It comes a few hours after the statutory instrument 149 had been released into the public domain. So it seems like a strategy to distract from the issue at hand, which is why the statutory instrument was just dropped out of thin air when the government was making promises that the Zim dollar will return in at least 9 months.
The announcement by ZANU-PF Youth Wing came after government introduced the Zimbabwean dollar as the sole currency of trade and forbade local transactions in foreign currencies. Critics say this could spark fresh factional battles within ZANU-PF. But Dodo says the nation should pay them no attention.
There will always be factions within ZANU-PF and they might use each other to fight petty wars, but at the end of the day, nothing will happen to those people, as we have seen. At best, you'll find that it's ZANU-PF Youth League members who are naming and calling that will end up getting into trouble. There are internal squabbles within ZANU-PF and they're using the press and the media to fight those things, but they will always be dealt with within ZANU-PF and nothing will change at a national level, policy-wise.
Flamboyant youth leader Mayor Justice Wajga Jena has lashed out at his fellow youth league leaders for naming and shaming bigwigs. Lawyers representing the Reserve Bank Governor of Zimbabwe have served papers to Matutu, indicating their intention to sue for 1 million Zimbabwean dollars if accusations are not withdrawn. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
The Zimbabwean government has effectively terminated the multi-currency regime, which has been in operation since 2009, in a move that it says will strengthen the local currency. Adigando gives us more on the reaction to the move by residents in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo.
Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube has effectively terminated the use of foreign currencies in Zimbabwe, so only the local RTGS will be allowed for transaction purposes. That will bring an increase in the supply of foreign currency into the interbank foreign market by ensuring that at least 50% of the surrender portion of foreign currency is sold to the interbank market. This will be supplemented by the use of letters of credit for importing essential commodities, including fuel, cooking oil, and wheat. The government says this move is intended to mitigate the impact of the new measures on ordinary citizens. The country has been dealing with a growing economic crisis in which the prices of goods and services has been denominated in foreign exchange and inflation is pitched at 396% by economic analysts such as Stephen Hanke. According to the Consumer Council of Zimbabwe, the price of a food basket stands at RTGS $1,000, while civil servants average RTGS $400 a month. Some observers see the multi-currency regime termination as an attempt to deal with the mounting pressure from the civil service to receive their salaries in US dollars. Analyst Thomas Stolle sees the government move as political expedience.
They are trying to address the restive population, but mostly civil servants who have been threatening to go on strike, given the fact that civil servants are not being remunerated in US dollars, and they've been pushing to be remunerated in US dollars. And the argument has been that goods and services are priced in US dollars and other currencies that we obtain.
Government met on Friday with leaders of the Apex Council, the civil service representative body, over worker demands for pay raises. A commitment was made to raise salaries, a move which observers say will force the government to print money. The finance minister has been at pains to assure the nation that the move marks a return to normalcy and that citizens' foreign exchange accounts will not be affected.
If you have US dollars in the bank account, in a foreign currency account, Moscow account, it's your money. You can keep it there, do whatever you like with it, except that if you want to go into a shop, within Zimbabwe, you have to change it into domestic currency.
The critics say government's seeming sincerity remains suspect and people are skeptical. The former government raided citizens' foreign currency accounts in 2008 in a desperate move that dented public confidence in the banking system.
There is no genuineness on the part of government. Well, they accuse of people, obviously, who are withdrawing money from their nostro accounts. Obviously, the announcement by there is a panic draw of foreign currency, and there is also panic buying. So I've been to Nedbank, I've been to Barclays Bank. There is panic from the people with nostro accounts. They are withdrawing everything they've saved there in the form of forex, because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. The people are reminded once again of the government's move to raid foreign currency accounts.
On Tuesday, most shops in Bulawayo were no longer accepting foreign exchange in a bid to comply with the new policy. Prices remained pegged at the parallel market conversion rate. Implementation of the new policy will prove a challenge in the Matabeleland region. It is unique in that thousands of dwellers left the region for South Africa in the early 80s due to state reprisals over alleged dissident activities. Some analysts say their numbers now range from 500,000 to 1 million living and working South Africa and Botswana, or emit the rand and pula currencies. Bakizanani Dube, a Plumtree school teacher, sees problems.
Especially looking at areas like Gwanda, Plumtree, Lupane, Cholocho, and of course Beitbridge that rely on using the rand and then the pula alongside other currencies that are acceptable in those areas. You see, those areas, most of their stock, they take it from outside the country. They take it from South Africa. You see, a large population of the people of those areas are in the diaspora for them to access the rand, and they, with or without the falling of the Zimbabwean dollar or the rise thereof, they have always been having the rand.
Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
21 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Egypt's Interior Ministry says terrorists killed 7 members of the country's security forces during 3 attacks on checkpoints near the northern Sinai town of El Arish late yesterday. A number of terrorists were also reportedly killed during ensuing gun battles. Edward Yerenian reports from Cairo.
The attack on Egyptian security forces took place as much of the country was on high alert for the Africa Cup of Nations soccer tournament. Egypt's Interior Ministry says the attack on a police meeting center took place late Tuesday outside the northern Sinai port city of El Arish. 4 attackers were killed, including a man thought to be a suicide bomber. Qatari-owned Al Jazeera TV reported that the Islamic State militant group claimed responsibility for the attack on its Amaq website. VOA could not independently confirm the claim, nor is it clear who is behind the website. Egyptian state TV reported that the Tuesday attack coincided with the start of the trial of suspected terrorist Hisham al-Ashmawi, who was handed over to the Egyptian military by Libya's armed forces, who are loyal to General Khalifa Haftar last month. Ashmawi is wanted for a number of high-profile attacks in recent years, including the 2015 explosion that killed General Prosecutor Hisham Barakat. Ashmawi was captured in the Libyan port city of Darna last October. Hilal Kashan, who teaches political science at the American University of Beirut, tells VOA that he does not think the Sinai attack is related to the trial of Ashmawi, nor to other ongoing events, including the conference in Bahrain to put an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He says that he thinks the insurgents in the northern Sinai launch attacks wherever they are capable and that they cannot mount operations on a daily basis. Therefore, he stresses, if the attacks take place during the conference in Bahrain, this is coincidental. Kashan says that he believes that the main support for the insurgents is coming from the Sinai Bedouin. He argues that the Egyptian government has failed to integrate the Bedouin into Egyptian society and has not been sympathetic to their social or economic plight. Egyptian media, however, accuse other countries and groups, including Iran, Qatar, Turkey, Hezbollah, and Hamas, of supporting the militants. Jazeera TV claimed that the militants were driving 10 four-wheel drive vehicles during the attacks late Tuesday. It was not clear how such vehicles could have been brought into the Sinai without the help of an outside country. Several anti-Egyptian websites also claim that the Sinai attacks were related to the sudden collapse and death of ousted former President Mohamed Morsi in a Cairo courtroom on June 17th. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Nigeria's movie industry, Nollywood, for many decades has largely depended on local movie distribution. But in the last decade, producers have been shifting focus from low-budget, high-volume production to quality, earning the industry more international recognition. In 2015, America's streaming giant Netflix started streaming Nigerian-made movies. But poor internet infrastructure and high data costs mean stunted growth for streaming services in Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian actress and filmmaker Happy Juliet has been in the industry for many years. Every year, she produces many low-budget movies to make up for low payments from local distributors and losses from piracy. But now, she says she's focusing on quality, hoping that her movie gets a shot at international limelight.
We the filmmakers, we've been suffering, and we are still suffering in the hands of these distributors. Because I don't see any reason why I should work for my money. Everything comes from me, and then you want to rip me off.
Nigeria's movie industry in Nollywood became popular and attained global recognition for its volume of production, ranked second to India's Bollywood. But that is changing. Technological advancements and online streaming are reducing the dependence of filmmakers on volume production and local distribution.
There's no how Netflix or Iroko or whatever will have my movie without me giving them. That means I have collected some money from them. So any movie we see there, definitely the producer must have collected part of the money or full from them before they can afford to put it online.
But eliminating the so-called middlemen or local distributors is only a part of the solution for Nigeria's filmmakers. Poor internet infrastructure and high data costs in Nigeria means, despite involvement of international and local online streaming services with producers, viewers still struggle to access movies.
Bothered us in the beginning, but again, it made us think outside of the box. So in order to tackle that challenge, we decided to go beyond data, and we decided to de-emphasize on our streaming aspect of our business and focus more on creating an app from scratch. Aside from that, we also came up with kiosks. So what the kiosk does is that it allows for our consumers to go to the kiosk and then they can download movies.
Despite showing the fastest growth rates in internet penetration, Africa remains in the bottom rank with only about 35.2% of the population using the internet. Nigeria's government has created an enabling environment for many broadband service providers to make cheap data available. But millions of movie lovers here still depend on local distributors, a practice that promotes piracy. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, how long can a head of state maintain effective leadership? Some African leaders are forced out of office, while others respect the political process. The politics of transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.